I've heard Alex share his story at Triangle. It was full of hope, full of recovery, and full of humor. Please welcome Alex.
Hello.
Thank you. My name is Alex. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I was reading this passage from the big book, There is a Solution, and it's one of my favorite passages. And I won't read the entire thing, but it talks about this businessman who couldn't stay sober, and he went to a psychiatrist in Europe, I guess Dr. Jung, who was extremely well known, and he went through, I guess, what would have been considered recovery. And Dr. Jung, this guy gets drunk right after that, and he goes to Dr. Jung, and he says, he returned to the doctor, whom he admired, asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society, and he would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was a great physician's opinion. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. And then, of course, it goes into a discussion of how to maintain that attitude and the spiritual solution. But that's how I felt when I got here at the age of 20. I essentially felt like my life was over and that, honestly, I could not or would not ever be able to function in society without alcohol. And, in my case, drugs as well. And, people will say, well, you're only 20 years old. And, of course, this was in 1980. But I don't think I ever took a drink or any, substances without the intention of, as soon as I did it, it was like I had been born again, man. I mean, this was it. I mean, I have found the solution. And, I did. I felt like I was doomed to die an alcoholic. And honestly, I don't think I really cared. I was so full of, anger and just rebellion towards kind of my society. I liked it. But I knew it was killing me. And I finally got to a point where I didn't want to die at, 25 years old. And so I came here, and, when we tell our story, it's what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I took my last drink on February the 5th, 1982. And, when I came in, if somebody told me they had 32 years, I'd have said, sure you do. And, I got a big brand new Ferrari out there in the parking lot. And because now somebody said a month, you have my attention, because I couldn't even go a week without. I tried it once and made it a week. But 32 years, but I do actually have 32 years. And you'll hear people say, well, we're all equal. Everybody, if you have it, that's bull crap. I got experience that I didn't have. Now, we are all sober today, but if you've got time, you've been through all sorts of things and stayed sober. And that, that's what I want to tell you about. And of course, today is the only day I have, but I'm certainly not like I was when I walked in. And frankly, if I was like I was when I got here, I would rather be drunk. because I was a selfish, miserable punk, like Rusty said. Rusty said, man, you were a punk. And I was. He was an angry Marine, and I was a punk. But now, you know, Rusty's one of my closest friends. I love him like a brother, respect him. And I think we're both miracles of this program, because if you knew us back then, you'd say, I know there's a lot of people, because I picked up 11 white chips before I got sober, who said I would never get sober. And I know with Rusty, you know, he had other issues. And it just shows you what a miracle, you know, this program is. And, you know, it kind of fascinates me that people say they don't believe in God and all this God crap. I can promise you there is a God. Just the fact that we're all sitting in here, you know, not drinking. Hey, son, if we were together in here and there was booze and everything else, son, there you'd have to send every DeKalb County police, because we'd burn this place to the ground, and them too. I mean, they'd have to send Fulton County out here as well, because you know how we are. I mean, I know how I was. Somebody would come up here and just knock me out immediately. I don't like you. I don't know why. And, you know, I mean, that's how we are. But I was, you know, I don't have, it's interesting when you look at your parents. I mean, when I came in, when you're younger, you look at your parents and this, oh, my daddy didn't treat me right and blah, blah, blah. But as I've gotten older, you know, I just turned 54. I have two children. I have four grandchildren. I have a lot different opinion of my father and my mother. I have a great deal of respect for them. I mean, you know, when you expect a man, my dad, who was an alcoholic but came out of the Depression, to, you know, feel and, you know, relate to me and coddle me. And why didn't you do that? Hell, he thought if he put food on the table, baby, I'm doing enough. I mean, what do you mean you want me to feel your feelings? I mean, get out of here. You know, somebody was on Iwo Jima, they're not too concerned with, you know, my feelings. And I think a lot of our generation, you know, raised in the excesses of the 60s and 70s by parents who came through the Depression and World War II. I mean, if you fought the Japanese or the Nazis, I don't give a damn about how you feel, son. I put food on the table. Now get out of here. So, you know, there was that, you know, this friction. And I experienced all that. And my dad was an alcoholic, and I'm an only child, and I grew up around, he was a businessman, and, you know, when you're an only child, you're kind of a third wheel. You're like a third adult. And I mean, I was just kind of drug around with him to his deals, and, you know, with back in the 60s, I mean, you know, the alcohol flowed, and you know, waitresses wore skimpy skirts, and stewardesses were magnificent, and, you know, all, I mean, people, my dad played poker, and I was like, crap, man, I wanted to, you know, I mean, my wife asked me, don't you know any nursery rhymes? I'm like, no, I actually knew how to bet a point spread before I knew how to ride a bicycle. In fact, one of my earliest memories was the, I think in the 1968 Super Bowl, the Colts were 17-point favorites over the Jets. And I bet this kid at Sunday school, of course, that the Colts would annihilate this upstart with the Fu Manchu from New York named Joe Namath, and I lost my $5. But I did win it back when Frazier beat Ali in 1970. I do remember that. So, but I mean, I enjoyed adult things. I wanted to drink. I mean, I wanted to gamble. I wanted to go to the Chanticleer restaurant and talk to the waitresses. And, you know, these things were appealing. You know, going to school and reading nursery rhymes and Mr. Rogers and all that was not very appealing to me. But, you know, I was kind of a mess because I was a mama's boy on the one hand. My mother had breast cancer when I was 9, and, you know, she survived it, thank God. But on the other, you know, so I was very much a mama's boy. But on the other hand, I had this dad who kind of was, you know, the alcoholic with the anger. And, you know, so I would
I mean, I was, you know, bullied to a certain extent, but then pushed beyond a limit. I would react in a way that was, you know, completely unacceptable. I can remember one instance where my father came in drunk, and I think I was 12, and, you know, they used to do this initiation for junior high where they would put shaving cream on you, and he didn't really get it, and he said, "God dang, if somebody picks on you," and he whips out this big fishing knife, he goes, "You get them with this." And so, you know, I said, okay. And so I remember soon thereafter, one of my friends wouldn't get off my bike. And I said, you know, "Get off my bike, get off my bike." And I said, "Well, no, screw you." I said, "Well, I'm going in, I'll be back." And, you know, "Where are you going? Tell your mom." And I said, "Yeah." And I came out with a butcher knife. And I said, "Get off my bike." And he said, and whew, up the hill he went. Of course, you know, 10 minutes later, phone, wow, 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 wow. And, you know, "My dad, you did what?" And I said, "Yeah, you told me to, man." He said, "Wow. No, I didn't." I said, "Yeah, you did." And, of course, my mother, who was witness, said, "Yeah, you did." So I was kind of raised in this, you know, this dichotomy of, you know, this alcoholic with his, you know, the world does something to you, fight back. And my mother, who's considered a saint, that she stayed married to my father for 60 years. And, you know, I just, I was kind of a mess. And you know, people see me now and they say, "Well, you're big," and all. I'm very frightened. And I think when you're frightened, you know, you react. Most people that I've met who are tough guys are scared to death. I mean, scared to death. And all that tough, you know, that macho crap is a cover. I mean, you're just a little boy. And that's what I was. I was scared to death. And to some degree, you know, fight that even today. At times I'll look at my life and go, "That you're just an imposter. I mean, you don't really, you know." And again, that's, you know, that's the alcoholism, the extremely inflated ego, but yet this incredible sense of, you know, of, say, fear, but, you know, I don't, self-esteem, I don't know all that crap, but just afraid, you know, afraid. And even when succeeding, saying, "Hey, this isn't really happening." And so I kind of, you know, booze just was the answer. I mean, when I found alcohol, it was like, this is it. And, you know, my father, I would, and again, I'd steal his liquor, and he would, you know, most parents would say, "Well, son, you shouldn't drink." He'd say, "Damn it, if you're going to drink, buy your own." And so, you know, so I wasn't really getting a lot of pushback from that regard. And then when I got into drugs, and, you know, I would leave paraphernalia and stuff, and they'd come in and get my room, I'd say, "Man, you know, who in the hell are you to tell me what to do? You're out there boozing and speaking the way you do to my mother. And, I mean, you got no right to tell me anything." So I developed this extremely bad attitude, and I still have that today towards authority. And so, you know, and I think I kind of grew to hate my father, but, you know, because of the drunkenness and the, you know, the way he treated my mother. And but, you know, we were doing our own thing. I mean, it was, I'm not going to go in, y'all know the drill. I mean, you drink, you shoot dope, you end up with, you know, bad people, you end up sleeping with, you know, ugly men, ugly women, and everything in between. And, you know, you end up thrown in jail. I mean, I'm not going to stand up here and give you some story like I'm some tough guy that, you know, has been to prison and, you know, used to fight and whip people. And I didn't do that. I'd fight occasionally. I'd get some shots in, and other times people get their shots in on me, and sometimes I just damn ran. If I saw a big guy look like he had a gun, I'm running. I'm not hanging out for that. And so, you know, I've heard these speakers that, I remember when I first came in, it's interesting when you come in the program, you'll hear these speakers, and then you realize half that crap was made up. You know, like, "I rode with the Hell's Angels." And you remember that guy? Remember, you know who. And do you remember telling that story? Do you think it was true now? Maybe a quarter of it? maybe. But I mean, now, you know, I'm just a garden variety, middle class, alcoholic and drug addict. Grew up right here, Doraville, Georgia. I didn't want for food. I lived a very nice life other than the fact I was in an alcoholic home and, was a mess. But, I mean, I don't have any particular, I can tell you some funny stories, but, but that's all they are. There's funny incidents. I mean, deep down, I was troubled, and from the beginning, I was like, what's wrong with me, man? You know, I don't want to live this way. But yet, as I got into it, you get to where you don't know any other way to live. And then I kind of crossed over where it's almost like, this is my life. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and screw society. And you kind of, I almost became a proselytizer for, you don't get high? What the hell's wrong with you, man? I mean, you need to come here with us. Because I didn't do anything else well. I mean, I'd been thrown out of athletics. I was actually quite bright, but I had screwed up in school, so I became a drunk. And that's who I was. That's how I identified. And because everything else that I aspired to was gone. I got thrown out of athletics when I was 15 for, coaches don't take kindly to you getting arrested for felonies on the school grounds, They're not, this was the 70s. There wasn't any, let's get him some help. It was like, I remember the head football coaches, you are a bad kid, and we don't want your kind around. So you're done. There was no, let's work with you. So once those doors were shut, then I was off. And it just, it just went down, down, down. And so, to keep the, what it was like short, I had a friend whose mother was real big into, she was one of the original, helicopter moms. When her son went into booze and alcohol and drugs, she kind of got on the governor's committee to stop adolescent, drug, all this stuff. And she took him to Peachford. And, this was my running buddy. And he was, face it, if you're an alcoholic, you don't hang around with social drinkers. That's why all your old friends are calling you back. I mean, you don't hang around with normal drinkers. And those people that are saying, man, what's wrong? You ain't got a problem. Well, hell, of course you do, and so do they. And if you get sober like I was trying to do, they're going to say, man, if he's got a problem, ooh, maybe I do. So, my buddies and all this gotten into this AA stuff. I'm like, what the hell is that? That's for old people. Old gray-haired men without teeth. And so they put him in Peachford, and I went over there to see him, and I was like, man, you're getting brainwashed, dude. In fact, I broke him out of Peachford, and we went. I mean, this is sad. You do things when you're drinking you think are funny, but you look back and you think, man, I might have had a hand in really harming another human being that was trying to get sober. He was in Peachford, and we went over there, and he snuck out, and I said, let's go to the liquor store. And, so we went to the liquor store and got some Jack Daniels, and he snuck it back into Peachford. And he started drinking, but this is what's sad. This is what I think about. He said, we laughed. We thought this was so funny. Because, I'm thinking like Days of Wine and Roses. He said he gave it to this old guy, and that guy goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. He just sucks it down. And I'm like, oh, God dang, that old man. Well, now I look back. That guy might have died because of our... Now, he didn't have to pick it up, but we provided it. I mean, we thought that was so funny. Well, he's one of the few people to actually be thrown out of... when you get thrown out of drug rehab, they won't even take your insurance money. I mean, it's a bad thing. But he ended up... that's like, what? was conduct unbecoming to the mentally ill. That you always say. I love that, man. So, but my buddy, he went on Phil Donahue. I mean, it was a big freaking joke. Remember Phil Donahue, that smart ass, and you know, the original hand ringer, you know. And so he was on there. He was wasted. I mean, and he was tired. Oh yes, I'm free from drugs. But anyhow, he finally did get sober. And he disappeared. We were together, and he was living with this guy dealing drugs and all this. And he got sober. And, you know, and again, I'm not trying to, you know, I don't want to do the, you know, singleness of purpose, baby. I always kept a bottle of Golden Grain around to take a good hit. It's like gasoline. I mean, I love to get drunk, but also anything that would get me high was going to do, from Ultraband 5000 in a cylinder to snorting contact to drinking Golden. I mean, I was going to do it. But anyhow, he disappears and he gets straight. And I'm kind of reaching the end of my sordid road, you know, and I called him. And my last night getting high, I remember we drank moonshine and, you know, you lit it to make sure it burned blue. If it burns green, there's the wood poison that blinds you. So we drank moonshine and did all sorts of drugs. And I remember the last, here's how insane I was. I said, listen, I've never shot dope, and I know that I want to get sober. So what I'm going to do is I want to shoot up, you know, cocaine tonight, so I can kind of go out with a bang. So I, you know, I had this is God's hand. I really believe this, because I shot up once and it was like, you know, I had done coke before and it's like finding, oh, but then shooting up is even more like. But I remember here I am in this dingy, stinking bathroom, and my friend shoots me up and it's like, oh my God, that's fabulous for 15 minutes. And then I go back to him and I said, hit me one more time before I head home and, you know, kind of turn myself into my parents and say I want help. Well, he shook so bad he couldn't do it. Well, my heart started pounding so strongly. You know what? I think at times if he'd have hit me one more time, it'd have killed me. And then I think at that moment, maybe God was saving me. Because I went home that night and I told my parents I need help. And I called my buddy Ken. He took me to my first meeting. Of course, my parents were like, oh, don't go to those meetings, you know, that's the people there get high and all, because there was still this uncertainty. But I went to my first meeting with him. And what's interesting, I have to digress, he had taken me to a meeting at Peachford like about 8 months before. And of course, at that time, I had a pocket full of dope. And I said, man, let's get out of here. We had to go for his mother. And I saw this girl there. And she was in Peachford, and I saw her across the room, and it was like, oh, there, look at her. And so I said, man, let's meet that girl. He said, no, you can't meet that girl. I mean, she's trying to get sober. I said, well, let's break her out. He said, no. I said, well, I'm in love with her. He said, let's go. So we left, and I didn't think, and I tried to make eye contact with the girl. And the girl looked at me like, you piece of garbage, because she was, you know, she wasn't in. I said, whatever, let's get out of here. Well, anyhow, so my first meeting I'm going to, you know, my buddy and my first sponsor, another guy who was in Young, picks me up, and we're going to a meeting here at NAVA. It was the Monday night young people. There used to be a young people's meeting here that got thrown out because we talked about drugs too much. And the old timer said, you know, singleness of purpose, away with y'all. And so, but I said, is that girl going to be there? And my friend said, listen, man, you're, you know, no girls, you know, you're here to get sober. I was like, okay. Well, I walk in and guess who's standing right there? That girl, who is now my wife of 33 years. We started dating. I mean, I went to my first meeting, they're all saying, well, you can't. I said, oh, boy, crap, I can't. Because when our eyes met, it was like, yeah, she had 7 months. And when we started dating, and I had a week. And we've been together ever since. Contrary to the, you know, I figured out, though, some of these old guys that really get on you about dating, hell, they just don't want you. They didn't want me to take all these young girls they were chasing. No, you stay away from those young girls. I'm like, man, you're 35 chasing a 17-year-old. What's up with you, you know? They were. That was their motivation. They just, and John, my friend John was there. He was already dating another girl, right? It was good. There was all these, it was like the first wave of young people. So it was like, God, you know, it was incredible. It was like, and we're sober. But I remember I came to my first meeting, and I'll never forget, because it's like, you know, it says in the big book that another alcoholic can gain the confidence of another drunk just like that. And when I came in and just listened for a few minutes, like, God, these people, these are my people. I mean, this is what I've got. And it was like, my God, there is a solution. And people could say, well, you were only 20. Listen, I knew from the first time I drank, there was no going back. I could have been in these meetings at 15. And at that time when I came in, you know, the young people, there was always this, well, I spilled more than you ever drank. And, of course, you'd say, well, if you hadn't spilled so much, you wouldn't have waited till you're 60 to get here, old-timer. I mean, there was kind of this friction going on, you know, between the young and the old. And we were talking about shooting dope and all that. And, you know, it's like, oh. I mean, there was a big friction, but yet I bonded. I mean, when I met these young people, it's like, God, because I thought, you know, how are you going to live? How am I going to live without alcohol, you know, and with drugs, you know? So I came in and I got into this program and I got my girl and, you know, I was chasing her and sober, and it was a beautiful thing, and found God, and feeling, you know how you feel so grateful when you finally, it's like, God, I've made it a month. I remember picking up my first 30-day chip. It was like, my gosh, 30 days without alcohol or drugs. It was magnificent. It was a miracle. And so, you know, we were dating and just having this grand old time. It's pretty, AA's a lot of fun when you don't have any responsibility. I mean, I was working at the landscaping crew and working on my suntan. I was 20 and coming to meetings at night and living off mom and daddy. And lo and behold, my girlfriend is with child. And I'm 20 and she's 18. It's like, reality has slapped me in the face again. And, I mean, I was kind of glad, so was she, but it's like, oh, it's decision time. What are you going to do? And there were people, it's interesting, that pray, oh, just get rid of that kid, man. It'll affect your sobriety. Damn right. If we had gotten rid of that kid, it would have affected my sobriety. I'd have probably died drunk. What, you get rid of my kid, go kill it so I don't affect my, that, what kind of thinking is that? Here I am. It's my chance to be a man. And I went to my dad. He said, listen, boy, he said, it's time for you to be a man. I mean, you know, hey, what do you mean? And it's amazing. You can find the answer you want to hear in here. If you go around long enough, you can find, and there were people, oh, you don't want to have a kid. You'll not stay sober and get married. Yeah. Well, praise God, we got married. And I think I told someone one time, I said, listen, if you think we should have an abortion so strongly, why don't you tell that kid about 21 years from now when he's 6'5", 240, which he is, that you thought we should get rid of him. And y'all can work it out together. And Frank, you know, he just had his first child about 6 weeks ago, a boy. But so we got married, and I got drunk immediately. As I was, again, I was scared to hell. I was scared to death. Not to mention the fact, oh, you mean it's not, you know, it's not all lovey-dovey, and she has, like, you know, what, the toothpaste here, and what the hell's going on around here, man? I mean, so all of a sudden we're married, and I'm drunk. And I was like, God, I mean, I need to run back home to mama and crawl up under the sheets. And I remember I tried to go home after being married about 6 weeks. And my dad told me, he said, boy, and it's the best thing I ever heard. He said, listen, this is what's going to happen. You can either go sleep under a bridge or you can go to your house. You're never coming home. And I was like, oh. And so I had to go home, and I had to get sober. And I bounced in and out of this room for about 2 years. If you're a chronic relapser, there's hope. I mean, there's people that said I would never make it. And but you know what I did? I came in and went to a lot of NA meetings. And, NA is wonderful, but the problem in 1980 was NA. The most sobriety in NA was about probably 5 years. And if you had 5 years, you were a guru. And, you know, but the thing that got me is there was a lot of these guys with 5 years who were still living like they were getting high, you know. I mean, I'm sorry, man. I want to get sober. I want a job and an education and an American Express card. I don't want to live under a damn bridge sober and, you know, keep cutting grass. And so I went to AA. And back then, man, I mean, them people were, I mean, some old guy sat me down and said, boy, you're going to die. You are going to die, and you ain't going to see 25 if you don't sit down and shut up and stop talking all your garbage and listen. He said, I'll sponsor you, but here's what's going to happen. You don't call me after 10. You don't call me on Sunday. You don't call me if you hadn't called me in a month or two whining about how you're going to get drunk or going to blow your brains out, because I don't want to hear it, because I should have heard from you earlier. And he said, and we're going to work these steps. And he said, if you want to do that and you can go along with that, that's fine. If you can't, then go ahead and die drunk. And that's what I started doing. I started working these steps. And I took my last drink after, you know, I had my last slip on February 5th, 1982. Ended up out in the yard with my pants around my ankles and, you know, puke on me. And of course, my wife, who's never taken a drink, she's been sober, I think, 35 years since she was 17. She walks past me and goes, hi, you want some breakfast? And, you know, I'm like, oh. But I remember the night before that, I remember I woke up that morning and I'd crawled back into my son's bedroom. He was one. And I remember that he was standing up over the crib looking at his drunken 22-year-old father on the ground, and I said, I don't want him to grow up like I did with a drunken father. And I think that was kind of the moment that reality hit me, that I don't want my kids to grow up with a drunken dad. And so, you know, that was one of those moments of clarity where God spoke to me. And I got in this program and, you know, started working the steps. And I mean, I didn't have a lot of problem. I knew my life was unmanageable. I mean, like I said, I knew it was just I didn't want to do anything about it. It's when you talked about, I mean, I thought the world owed me a living. What do you mean? I have to work the steps. You know, I hear people talk about now, will you work me through the steps? No. I mean, you can call me if you have questions, and I'll be glad to share my experience, strength, and hope. But only I could do the work. I mean, I had to do the work, and I didn't want to do work. Work was not in my vocabulary, and that had to change. I mean, I had to learn how to work, not only steps. I had to learn how to work again as an employee. I mean, I'd do crazy stuff. You know, I worked in a bakery downtown. Remember one night driving to work before I got sober, the Braves were in town against the Pirates. Willie Stargell, Dave Parker, Manny Sanguian, you know, Tim Foley, Doc Ellis, one of us. I said, crap, I'm going to see the Pirates. And I just pulled in, didn't go to work. You know, they're calling the house. Where's your son? It might be dead. And, you know, that kind of stuff. If I felt like I needed a day off, I just took it. And then, you know, the boss the next day, where were you? Yeah, I think he even said, I said, well, it was the Braves game. He's like, hell, why didn't you call me? I'd have met you there. But, you know, that was I remember calling Lance, I have a brain tumor. I won't be into work. You know, I just would make stuff up because I didn't want to work. But I learned all this, you know, started to be a good employee and having to work steps. But I was having to relearn all this stuff. But I didn't want to work. I wanted to just live and have someone take care of me. And that's just alcoholic thinking, the worst sort, you know. And that's just being a little boy, just running high, take care of me, mama. Except now it's like, take care of me, have my wife take care of me. And You know, I got in a relationship with God. I didn't really have a problem with the God thing. I mean, if you're raised in the South, I mean, we'd be drinking whiskey. Somebody didn't say they believed in God. I mean, we had to fight. Like, what the hell are you talking about? You don't believe in God, man. I mean, you know, Leonard Skinner, Simple Man, you know, all that stuff. I mean, you don't, you know, what do you mean you're an atheist? Might have to smash you over the head with my Jack Daniels bottle, man. I mean, come on. So, I mean, I didn't really, but see, God to me was just kind of a, you know, who cares? Yeah, I believe in God, whatever, man. I didn't actually believe that somebody actually might, there might be, he might have created me for a reason other than just satisfying my whims. You know, that God actually might have a will for me instead of, you know, this Santa Claus I had constructed. You know, hey, man, I'm going to jail. I better pray. Or, you know, I need a job, God. I mean, or, you know, you need to get me out of this fix. Maybe I was created to help other people. That type thing. You know, the talks about what is your will for me? I had it in reverse. What is my will for you, God? Here's my list. Here, please sign off on it. Praise God. And everything's beautiful. Like the preachers of L.A., on, you know, reality TV. You ever see those clowns? I got my Bentley and my, you know, that, well, whatever. I mean, no. I mean, that's what the program taught. What is your will to help another alcoholic? And so, you know, I got in the program and things started going well, which they do. It's amazing. If you work the steps and go to meetings, you start, things do start happening. You start getting jobs and you all these things start. Well, I got real cocky. I thought I was, I got back into church, became a Christian, and, you know, returned to my faith and all these things. Well, I don't need AA anymore. I don't need to be around all those scuzzy people. They don't act right. Well, no, the problem was I started not acting right again. And what happened is I started making money and traveling, and I wasn't drinking, but I found another interesting I don't know how you would put it. Some people would call it an addiction, an obsession. I found something I brought back I'd had before, and that was women. Here I am married and sober, but yet I've discovered prostitutes and strip clubs, and I'm out cheating on my wife. And, you know, it's a pitiful thing when you look in the mirror and there ain't no booze to blame it on. You're just a down, low-down scumbag, selfish son of a bitch who just decided that he didn't need to maintain his wedding vows and that my desires were more important than my wife who wasn't treating me right. You know, you always construct these excuses when you start behaving like that. Oh, she don't treat me the way she should. So I'm back leading this really double life now. I'm going to AA meetings and spouting all this crap and running this other game. Well, it almost destroyed my marriage. It almost destroyed my wife. You know, she went into this, and, you know, I mean, I don't know, you know, I think there's spiritual forces that are let loose. Well, she ends up in this horrible depression. And, of course, that opened my eyes up to depression, too. My wife ends up essentially catatonic at about 10 years sober in the bed. And, of course, it's amazing, again, the bullshit you get. And I'm sorry, excuse my language. But, you know, the big book talks about make use of religious people, make use of doctors, psychiatrists. I mean, you know, what's wrong with Claudia? Well, she's in the bed. She can't function. Well, she needs to be grateful. Like, she needs to work a step. What step do you work when you're in the bed and you're catatonic? I mean, really? She's suicidal? What step would you have her work? I mean, come on. Well, you know, that medicine stuff. Really? Okay, let's see. Your background is you slept under a bridge for 8 years. And then we have this guy that's been to Harvard Medical. Oh, I'm going to listen to you. It's like flying a jet with some guy who's been playing on his Xbox. Come on, man. So, you know, my wife ends up in Peachford again. She'd been in Azalea because she ends up in there depressed. And it's interesting, we went to counseling and everything, and the counselor told me, she said, "You might have put her there." Boy, that was like somebody just took a bat and bam. And when she comes out, she might not want to be married to your sorry ass. Man, now I was reeling. And we also, I remember we went to a meeting and spouting all this stuff, and this old time lady comes up. She goes, "You know, y'all don't go to meetings anymore. Y'all benefited from the program and you come back." She said, "Have you ever thought how incredibly selfish it is? You and your wife come in here. You construct this magnificent life. You've got your house, your money, your beautiful kids. And what about the people behind you? You know, what about them? You're just going to run off and benefit from the program and kiss everybody else goodbye." And that was another kind of moment. And she was right. And so at about 10 years sobriety, baby, my whole world crashed down. And that's when I had to do some serious soul searching and get right in this program. And, you know, my wife, she teetered on the brink of, you know, having an affair. Why wouldn't she? She wasn't getting nothing from me. And we fought like hell, man. We fought for years, but, you know, we, thank God, I mean, we used to pray to you and we worked through it and we're young and all that, but went to counseling. I mean, we took advantage of everything imaginable once we kind of, I've been to meetings, I've been to church, I've been to Bible studies, I've been to psychiatrist, I'm on Medicaid. Baby, I will do anything to stay sober and not go back to where I came from, but also not to go back to where I came from, where I was at 10 years of, I hesitate to use the word sobriety. I was dry, baby. You just struck a match. And so, you know, I mean, the last number of years, I mean, I don't really know what to tell you, man. You know, sobriety's a struggle, but it's a beautiful life. I mean, that was my problem when I was using, and before I got here, I just wanted to run from everything. Anything that didn't go my way, I'll take my toys and go home. It's got to be your fault. And, you know, even today, I mean, you know, even today, I find, you know, I'm not being treated properly. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to go, it's like a baby, think about it, you go pick up a bottle and suck on it, like a damn baby. You know, I sucked my thumb when I was 5, so I'll suck on my bottle of Blackjack when I'm 35. I mean, that's all, you know, that's all I was trying, you know, doing. So, I mean, sobriety's tough, but what a beautiful life to be able to go through the vagaries of life. I mean, I know people in here that have lost children, that have lost spouses, that have lost jobs, that have been bankrupt, that have gone through tremendous depression, and yet they press on. They stay sober. That's what I wanted to do, man. I always wanted to just be a part of life like regular people who didn't run when something went bad. Run back to my bottle. Run back to my booze and my drugs, you know. And, I have a life today. I mean, I got 2 beautiful children. I have 4 grandchildren. I own a business that I bought from a drunk. But you know what? People say, "Well, you don't need, man, I need meetings as bad or worse than I do today than when I came in." The program has afforded me another career. I decided I was sick of business. I said, "Hell, I want to be a teacher." People say, "Well, you can't teach. Why not? I want to coach, man. I threw my athletic career away. I want to go coach." So about 10 years ago, I went back to school and started teaching middle school. And can you imagine? And somebody said, "Well, who taught you? Who taught me? What if I fail? So freaking what? I'll go back to selling doors." I mean, you know, that's the program gives us that opportunity to do whatever we want to do if we're willing to work, like the book says. So I coach football now, and, you know, I bought a business from the guy who took me to my first meeting, which was about dumber than hell. I mean, he went back out. But that's what keeps me coming, is I've seen people with 20 years go back out. The guy who took me to my first meeting and who I bought the business from, yeah, I'm smart, because he started drinking again. And after 20 years of sobriety, guess what? He just got busted over in Alabama
about a year ago for distribution of marijuana within 5 miles of a school, you know, at age 53. Now, this is a guy who 5 years ago was making $500,000 a year, had this incredibly thriving business, but he went to China and he took a drink. And I said, what the? And then he tried to get me to go with him. He said, well, man, when you're in China, you got to do like they do. I wouldn't want to offend them. I said, well, hell, you didn't eat the fish eyes, man. What you got to drink the whiskey for? I mean, you know. But he did. And, oh, at first it's like, I got it under control. Well, he's back doing what we're doing, blasting Led Zeppelin, growing weed, and he's lost everything. I got another friend who lived in my neighborhood who he just wanted to retire at 50. And he did. And he never even showed any signs of alcoholism. He retired at 50, started drinking. Lo and behold, becomes an alcoholic, and he died about a month and a half ago. Drank himself to death. This is the original self-made man. I mean, he was, you know, brilliant real estate guy, started retired at 50, started drinking, came to meetings, couldn't get it, died. So I could be back out there in a minute. And you know what the frightening thing is, I can do a hell of a lot more damage now. I ain't got to scrounge around, steal 20 bucks from my mama. I mean, when you get a job and stuff, I could go out and probably buy some nice stuff, you know. And I could be right where my buddy is, right back down in a hole. And so, I don't take for granted my sobriety. And I'm just one drink away from being right back where I came in. And, I love being sober. And I'll tell you one quick story and I'll close. This shows you how good God is. I got busted when I was 15. I'll end with this. This is pretty profound. I was 15 years old. I was playing JV basketball. I went and did a bunch of barbiturates, which drank a bunch of Mad Dog 2020 that we stole from the grocery store, sucked it down, went and busted up a bunch of cars, and got busted at the, you know, at the school. That's what I was talking about. And they wanted to send me up to Alto. It was just ugly scene. I, you know, mouthed off to the cops. Imagine that. And that's where the coach said, we're done with you, boy. And that was it. I just went back out. And I never played sports again. And that was kind of my aspirations, was to play football. And, I mean, I loved athletics. And I still regret it today to some degree. But what happened is when I started coaching, I was coaching this kid who came in. He got busted. He almost the exact same time in his life. He was in the 10th grade, and he was playing football for us. And he went and almost ran over these kids in his mother's car. He was drunk as hell. And he, excuse my language, and he got thrown out of the school. But what happened was, is I said, hey, you know, I'm a member of the AA. Would you be interested in going to a meeting? And his mother's in the program, so I started taking him to meetings, and he got sober. Well, what was so wonderful is I was able to go back to the headmaster of our school and say, look, I want to vouch for this boy. We need to let him back into the school and let him resume his career, you know, playing football. And the headmaster said, okay, I'm going to do that because you vouch for him. Now, we're talking about a teetotaling Baptist headmaster, buddy. I don't think he's ever sniffed whiskey. He said, I'm gonna let him in because of you. And this kid came back in the school, and he ended up playing his junior and senior year and got to play football in college. And now he has a job. He's got this similar life. But it was so, and I have a relationship with him, it was so fabulous how God kind of allowed to kind of rectify that situation. When I was 15 and I felt like I had thrown my life in the garbage can, to have that chance in that boy's life. And that's what the program does. If you stay sober, God is going to use every person in here in somebody's life. And that's my hope, man, for you. And that's what keeps me coming back and keeps me sober.
So I'm sorry I ran over a couple minutes, but I appreciate y'all listening to me. And thank you very much for asking me.